This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 13th of July 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound. This week, we're ending our series of Monocle guides to the summer and we're getting arty. I'll be joined by Ossian Ward, head of content at the Listen Gallery, to talk through some of the highlights of this year's summer art schedule, from the scorching south of France to a cooler Edinburgh, and with pit stops at Istanbul and Ljubljana in between, no less. And as well as that, we'll head to Porto, Washington and Vienna to visit a few shows that go rather well with the sunshine. All that coming up on this edition of Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. And we welcome Ossian Ward to the Culture Studio once again to give us the lowdown on the preview of what you might want to jump on a plane, hop in a taxi and go and see this summer in the sphere of arts. Ossian, as ever, welcome to the Culture Show.
Hi.
And first of all, you're taking us to the south of France. Poor things, all of us, to have to go and put up.
It's a tough job.
With the Flights of Fancy at the Arles Photo Festival. You've just come back from it. Tell us what your greatest hits
were. So it was a lovely, hot opening for the festival. Some of the best exhibitions that I saw there was one called Vernacular, and this was three collections by a French collector who'd found pictures of people posing with someone dressed up as a polar bear, which apparently was quite the done thing in 20s, 30s Germany. It was good luck. So you have these horrific pictures.
I've seen some of these.
Kind of hugging someone or standing next to a child who looks frightened or standing next to Nazi soldiers. So there's a whole suite of these things. Absolutely spooky. And then on the opposite side, you have a whole suite of blackface images. So, you know, people looking, you know, fairly cheerful about what they're doing, dressing up in blackface with the whole pickaninny haircuts and all that. Also bizarre. And then a third selection, perhaps the weirdest of all of them, in which all these little black and white photos just have the faintest silhouette or shadow of a man with a kind of trilby hat on. But it's kind of quite sinister because it's always in the foreground. And this series is just called Predator.
It sounds amazing and weird.
Yeah, and they're just found photographs.
Oh, these are found photographs?
Found photographs,
so there was
a
vogue in these days for the polar bear pictures.
The polar bear ones.
The blackface, presumably, it was you know, everything preceding the Black and White Minstrel Show. It was meant to be the essence of light entertainment, was this is how you dress up. How strange. Generally, the atmosphere of Arles, how did you find it to be? I mean, I wonder what you think about the idea of a photography festival being quite serious. We're lucky enough to go to lots of the art fairs and biennales, and there's an obvious seriousness about some of those things, but there's quite a joie de vivre as well, is there, in Arles?
Well, I mean, it's a smaller world. It's a similarly kind of closed, you know, circuit once you're in it. So maybe I'm not the best person to judge it because I'm not in the photography world per se, but yeah, there was a very nice party. The atmosphere was good. The weather was warm. I think, yes, there's a lot of organised events, lots of book signings. It's quite reverent. You know, you don't tend to get, the fringe doesn't really exist, like the kind of outside of the main event. There's not really too many things. But there is at least 20 shows to see in what is a very beautiful little ancient town where it only takes 10 minutes to get here or there. So you do meet people and you do kind of shake hands and nod. But you're right, it's probably not quite as let's say, free-flowing as the rest of the art world.
Let's stay in the south of France, shall we? Yeah. Should we move to Avignon, the Pope's favourite French city? And this is an interesting thing. So this is Yvon Lambert, who is a French art dealer. What's he done? Has he given up his day job?
Yeah,
he just
quit, and everyone was a bit surprised because he's probably one of the premier French dealers and has been for 50 years. So there was an eyebrow raised. I think he sort of mentioned something about the state of the market and the craziness and the fact that people were trying to invest in art and not really appreciate it. And funnily enough, he really is a good collector. Like, I hadn't realised how much work he has. And a couple of years ago, which is now just coming to light, he gave the largest donation of work since about 1900 to the French state. And this includes Louise Bourgeois and, you know, many kind of big installations. So he's always had a place in Avignon, but this time he is now expanded. I think he's doubled it in size. I last went a year or two ago when he'd taken over a former prison and installed works in that. It was great, you know, very atmospheric. And he's constantly doing things like that. So I think it's just the symbol of one man's passion, really, but done with lots of different artists. So they're not just artists he represented either. I think in terms of what there is to look at in Avignon, it's certainly added to this kind of triangle. There's almost like a little triangle in the south of France. So you've got Avignon, you've got Arles at the moment, and then coming up soon, we've got the Lyon Biennale, which is curated this year by Ralph Rugoff of our very own Haywood Gallery here in London. So that will be an interesting one.
That's an interesting one. Ralph Rugoff, as I say, people have seen lots of the shows that he's put on. He's the director, isn't he, of the mm-hmm. Haywood Gallery.
Yep.
I wonder how hands-on he is. It's quite nice to see a show that's specifically curated by him. It's a labour of love for him, actually. It'd be nice to see what his taste is.
Yeah, I mean, there are a few names that you will recognise, like George Kondo, who did a big show of at the Haywood Gallery. Mike Nelson's in this show. You know, Cyprian Gaylard has been in Haywood shows. So there's a few names that, you know, you could pull out. But basically, the Haywood is now undergoing these major renovations. So this Cast and Holler show that's on at the moment with all the slides and the decision making is going to usher in a period of massive refurbishment for, I don't know what they're doing to the South Bank, some huge new scheme. So, you know, Ralph's on kind of holiday, but, you know, he's straight into his a major biennial, you know, with lots of really interesting artists. So, you know, he's obviously decided to keep busy while the doors are shut.
Yeah. Yeah. Lyon itself as well is a lovely town to visit. Amazing restaurants in Lyon. The best place in France for food.
Really?
Yeah. Well, maybe that and Bordeaux. I mean, amazing. Yeah. That's properly lovely there.
I think you're right. And I think there's only a few. It's quite hard to get good food in South France. I know that sounds mad, but even the kind of the Michelin-starred places, you know, they're not all they're scratched up to be in terms of, you know, like quality. But there are other places like Saint-Paul-de-Vence where you have the hotel come restaurant called the Column d'Or, which is obviously the place that Picasso and all of those French artists stayed and painted on the walls. So, you know, whether or not the food's good, the atmosphere and the surroundings are good, let's say.
I like the way you've sort of essentially told us what your summer holiday might well be.
Yes.
So you're going from Arles.
Yeah.
Then you're going to Avignon,
yeah.
And then you're going to Lyon. Will you be doing that on a TGV or will you be hiring a Twingo?
En voiture.
En voiture. We're going to pause our chat with Ossian just for the time being, because we're going to go to the rest of our artistic dispatches this week. At TBA 21 in Vienna is a must-see exhibition that diverges from the usual art world fair. In a show called Sacred Secret, acclaimed Brazilian artist Ernesto Neto collaborates with artists and healers of the Huni Quin, an Amerindian indigenous people. TBA 21 is transformed into a series of spaces that oozes spirituality and respect for nature. Exhibition goers tend to linger amongst the crafts and artworks as they contemplate ritual, healing and ancestral knowledge. In Vienna, Monocle contributor Kimberly Bradley spoke to curator Daniela Zeman about the show's meaning.
Well, upon entering the space, you're asked to take off your shoes. You will step onto a blue sky, a blue fabric that Ernesto has created, so that the relationship between the floor, the sky, and the space is sort of inversed. Above you is a blue hanging sculpture with a very complicated name. You know, today we meet here, tomorrow we meet there. God and goddesses are all one, and Saint Gravity.
Its forms are breathtaking, room-filling undulations. Huni Quin weavings hang from the ceiling. On the wall, natives' paintings depict tribal symbols. And on a low table are maracas and blowpipes used to administer sacred medicine.
Space 2 is dedicated to the spirit. It's the ritual center of the exhibition. Actually, the entire space is covered by a tent-type structure made of crochet. And this tent represents the Kupishawa, the big gathering space. There's a big chandelier coming down from the center of the space, and it's called Bashne Puru Chanayubi.
Down on the floor's straw mats, viewers gaze at the webs above. The chandelier's name refers to myths of spiders and serpents. The forms evoke the shapes of native birds' nests.
The third space is the space of learning. It's mainly dedicated to one very important sacred book that was published a year ago in Hachakui, and it's called Livro da Cura, the Book of Healing.
The book, of which one copy in English exists here, describes the healing power of 109 plants, as outlined by a shaman's dream several years ago.
This book is a very important step because the knowledge of plants, the knowledge of curing, has been held very secretly because sharing this very secret knowledge was considered to be a very, very important social and communal step. And the Page Augustine felt that today was the moment to share it with the world at large.
Visitors literally hang out and read the Book of Healing and other books in hammocks made by Huni Quinn women. On the walls are drawings made by a delegation that came to Vienna in June. The exhibition's final space has a meditative wall drawing and audiovisual works. The collaboration began with NATO traveling to the Huni Quinn's Amazon forest home to learn about medicinal plants as the Book of Healing was being produced.
Basically, this first encounter with the Huni Quinn was life-changing for Ernesto. Upon encountering the Huni Quinn and encountering their medicinal practice, he suddenly understood that all his work and all his thinking about humanity, about our place on Earth, about how we all are interconnected, all of that was so deeply embedded in the ontology and the culture of the Huni Quinn.
The community was nearly decimated in the 1980s, but has grown to more than 3,800 members. On research trips, TBA 21 defined the exhibition, which also raises funds for water purification. How have visitors responded?
I think that the space itself is so transformative and so powerful. I think everybody who entered it could truly see the very deep engagement that Ernesto and the Huni Quinn have. I have not seen anyone who did not immediately sit down on the floor and take a moment of rest, sort of think about whatever spirits are in the space.
Future exhibitions and continued collaborations with NATO are in the works. It's about raising awareness and responsibility.
I think they have realized that they are the ambassadors of the forest.
TBA 21 offers children's workshops and open-air discussions in Vienna this summer, and in early September another Huni Quinn delegation arrives. Sacred Secrets is a show to experience again and again. For Monocle, in Vienna, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
That was Daniela Zeman speaking to Monocle's Kimberly Bradley at TBA 21 in Vienna. Sacred Secret is on until the 25th of October. After the break, we'll have more of Ossian's Arty Party summer holiday, and we'll be in Porto and Washington to report on this summer's exhibition hits.
The brand new M24 iPhone app brings you the full radio offering from Monocle 24. Listen live to our four daily news programmes or catch the freshest tunes on our playlist. And of course, there's the Time Shift, where you can delve into our show archive and listen at your leisure. All our great magazine programmes, covering everything from international affairs to culture, design to urbanism, food and drink to entrepreneurship. It's all available anytime on the new, free Monocle 24 iPhone app. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to Culture on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound. We're going to be hearing a little bit more from Ossian Ward in a few minutes, but first we're off to Porto. The work of influential Moroccan artist Ito Barada, the creative force behind Tangier's Cinematheque, is being shown for the first time in Portugal. She's bringing a little of her home turf with her. Salon Moroccan inaugurates a new annual programme at the modernist Casa de Saralves, part of the Saralves Museum in Porto. Simon Tarek meets curator Susanna Cotta to talk about the show, the first of a series of invitations to international artists to take over this captivating Art Deco villa.
In Ito Barada's film False Start, men silently chip away at stones using basic but inventive techniques. They are producing fossils, fake cultural artifacts, to meet the rising demand for such objects from northern Africa. I'm watching this film in a beautiful modernist villa in Porto, northern Portugal. The Casa de Serralves, located in the garden of the Serralves Museum, is hosting a new annual summer programme where artists are invited to present their work in this former Art Deco home. Museum director Suzanne Cotter explains more.
You know, since I arrived here in early 2013, I realised that the villa was an incredibly important component of the museum. The villa is part of the original grounds that were actually acquired by the state, handed over to the Serralves Foundation at the end of the 80s, and it was in the villa where the museum project really began. So during the period of the 1990s, there were important series of exhibitions, and especially when Vicente Todoli came in 1996, through to 1999 when the Caesar-designed museum was actually inaugurated. So I'm very interested in prehistories because I think, you know, they still exist. They're not ghosts. They're actually like their ongoing presences within museums, just in the way that archives are or collections in general. So it's how can we create some points of resonance and relationship with the villa and its history? It's a building, or it's a piece of architecture, a piece of interior design that one has to be very careful with because, you know, there's a risk that everything could just become far too theatrical. So it needs to be the right sort of artist that we invite to come and work here.
The chaos of Tangier is a far cry from the sleek 1930s building, with its peach facades, limestone interiors, and Brazilian oak flooring. Yet Ito Barada's subtle interrogations, stark photographs of toys belonging to Berber children, elegantly placed rugs made by the Darna Women's Association of Tangier, all managed to work to create a delicate cultural conversation.
I thought she was a fantastic choice for the villa because I thought that she would be really responsive to it and its context, situated within a landscape architectural program, which are the formal gardens designed by Jacques Robert. And given her interest in gardens, but also her interest in particular histories of modernism through the filter of colonialism in North Africa, how do we understand this? This idea of a cultural transfer and, you know, where is the origin and where is the end point and the fact that it's constantly in movement. So I felt that it was a context that would be extremely interesting to her spatially and overall, as well as visually. And then as it happened, she's been working on this series of different areas of research through ethnography, but also Paleolithic studies, etc., based in Morocco, but their relationship to certain campaigns that were carried out by French ethnographers in the 20s and 30s. The exhibition here created the opportunity for her to bring that thinking together. I decided on inaugurating an annual summer exhibition, the Villa exhibition, because I felt I wanted to give it an identity, so to connect with this history of the past, but also distinguish it from the other types of exhibitions one might see here. It's very nice to see now with the opening of Ito's exhibition, the way in which somehow the museum feels more balanced for me. I mean, it's a much less space than in the museum, but somehow the presence, knowing that there is an exhibition there, a work of an artist there, creates a different perception and a different experience of Schalwisch. It's not just the museum and the park, it's sort of, there's these different points, so it feels more balanced.
A visit to Casa de Schalwisch this summer is enhanced by Suzanne's new curatorial approach to the building, which allows us to discover new histories and identities in surprising corners. For Monocle in Porto, I'm Saima Tarek.
That was curator Susanna Cotta speaking to Saima Tarek at the Serralves Museum in Porto, and Salon Marocain is on until the 20th of September. Now we're back in the studio to continue our chat with Ossian Ward, head of content at the Listen Gallery. Where's he heading next on his summer holiday? Should we take a change of pace and talk about the Ljubljana Graphic Biennial?
I'll try, yes.
This is an interesting one. Nicola Lees of Frieze Projects, who's the new Frieze Projects curator, is putting this on. It's the kind of thing you can almost imagine being in Warsaw, such a great history of Polish graphic design, you know, and the way you film posters and book jacket covers and all the rest of it. Ljubljana means nothing to me, frankly. Yeah. But I mean, I think this is the kind of thing where it's the kind of thing that could put it on the map, not in a patronizing way, but it's kind of like, wow, you've got to go to that place.
Yeah,
I mean, it's capable of doing that, isn't it?
Well, and having been in Warsaw last weekend, I can imagine it's the same kind of idea, you know, a lovely old town and then these long boulevards, kind of slightly old Eastern Bloc style, you're never ending with trams going down it, you know, a sort of ex-Soviet feel and kind of crazy Stalinist architecture. But you know, Nicola Lees, like you said, of Frieze Projects fame, is bringing some interesting artists. So Oscar Murillo, we all know because of his kind of hot prices, he can actually wield a paintbrush or a pencil, I imagine, in this instance. So Sanya Kantarovsky is interesting, Andrea Butner. So, you know, these are not second-rate artists that she's bringing. So, again, you know, another reason to rock up into a bit of Eastern Europe for summer holiday.
Do you think photographers are more pompous than graphic designers? I interviewed Milton Glaser last week, which was a great pleasure.
Yeah.
You would have had, the man has very little ego, it seems to me. At the age of 85, he's a chilled out dude.
Yeah.
Despite, you know, founding New York magazine, coming up with the I Heart New York logo and a million other great things. I think photographers are more po-faced than graphic designers in my
estimation. No, I think you're right. My dad's a graphic designer, and I think they're a little bit more cool about the success. They're a bit, you know, they're not quite so reverent to each other. But I think in terms of opening it up to drawing and woodcuts and, you know, whatever else she can, this might be an interesting one, and certainly, you know, might add to my summer holiday plans now.
Okay, we've got two to tick off the list before we go. The Istanbul Biennial, this should be an interesting one. The documenter curator, Karolin Kristof-Bakarviev.
Yeah.
I always struggle with her name.
Yeah, I do too.
Is putting it together.
Yeah, Istanbul has also got a very long history in terms of the biennials and in terms of the hierarchies. It's up there. I think this one, because her current form is so strong with the last documenter, you know, we expect big things, but for once, the title and the thematics actually interest me, because usually I just look at these kind of grand overarching ideas and go, nah, that's going to be a waste of time. You know, I don't need to know
about the names of the theme shows of Biennales. They read like the pitches for fragrance companies.
Exactly.
Presumably putting out something new for Calvin Klein.
Yes.
It seems to me. They're about as nonsensical.
Absolutely aimed at everyone.
Between fact and breakfast.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And this one is called Saltwater, A Theory of Thought Forms. But to me, the watery theme is going to be interesting. And she's kind of tasking visitors with going back and forth across the Bosphorus. She's talking a lot about works in the kind of underground aqueduct type arches that they have there. So this is going to be a really atmospheric one with, I imagine, actually things in the water as well as you having to just traverse a lot of water. So although, you know, the actual theoretical text or the, you know, the introduction she gives is all about how we have salt in our body and that keeps us working. But funnily enough, she says if you're phone falls into the water, it's going to stop working, which I think is a bit of a weird introduction to a conceptual art pitch. But I like the idea that, you know, you could actually theme a biennial around the kind of structure of the city. So, you know, you make it relevant to the sites that you're going to be in.
Lastly, on Austin Ward's summer holiday, as this show shall be renamed, we're going to the Edinburgh Art Festival. A little bit chilly to finish off the summer, Alcyon, compared to the other places we've been. What is attracting you about the Edinburgh Art Festival?
Well, I mean, I've never been, because I think the fringe is so, you know, the Edinburgh Festival we look at in terms of theatre and comedy and all the rest of it. So this has always been like the poorer cousin. It's always been there in the background, but it's usually just been a kind of a museum exposition or something, you know, in the background to keep that side of things interested. But more and more, they're actually calling it the Edinburgh Art Festival. So they have some outside commissions. So everyone's favourite performance loony, Marvin Gaye Chetwynd, formerly Spartacus Chetwynd, is planning on doing something about... The title of this one is suitably strange. It's called The Improbable City, but she is looking at doing a kind of installation and an operatic thing about a Czech stage scenographer called Josef Svoboda, and pagan rituals and all this kind of stuff is going to be involved. So I imagine that will be a blast, and you know, I really like her work.
It's one of those nice things, you go after all the craziness of the comedy and the fringe, and you know, the Performing Arts Festival has disappeared.
Yeah.
And you kind of have a sense of discovery probably with some of this stuff.
Yes.
And it's a little bit, it's smaller, and you can see it all and enjoy it all and take it all in and have a drink afterwards and discuss what you've seen, which is kind of the point of these things. It's quite nice.
Yeah. And I think if we're talking about the relative seriousness of the art world or the photography world or the graphic world, I think, you know, the kind of comedy / theatre brigade are the most rowdy. So you can kind of avoid some of those drunken, lurching people on the streets of Edinburgh by going just after the kind of the madness has subsided.
If there's any scotch left in the bottle, it's all yours. Austin Ward, thank you very much for guiding us with your hand on the artistic tiller through this summer. Thank you. The only thing that could make an oceanside day in July better is a little air conditioning. In Washington, D.C., a new one-of-a-kind art installation is doing just that. Our reporter Amy Blazik visits the National Building Museum to speak to Vice President for Exhibitions and Collections, Kathy Frankel, and find out more about their 10,000-square-foot indoor beach. No sunscreen required, but don't forget your flip-flops and towel. We'll be swimming, sort of.
The beach is an installation here at the National Building Museum in Washington, D.C. It was designed by Snarkitecture, which is a design firm out of Brooklyn, New York. What you're looking at here is a giant white box, 200 feet by 50 feet, with a sloped floor in it, with the shallow end of the floor filled with somewhere between 700,000 and a million clear plastic balls. It's all white. The walls are white. The carpet's white. The balls appear white, even though they're a little bit clear. That's the concept of our designers, and it's working fabulously.
Standing here on the edge of the pier, one can only assume that Frankel is right. All you can see are smiles, and all you can hear are the sounds of deep belly laughter from young and old alike. This exhibit is a hit.
Where are you today?
The beach!
So tell me a little bit about what the beach looks like here.
The beach is covered in balls.
It's covered in balls, that's right. The balls are the water. It's beautiful.
And it's also really deep.
Let's go get them. Let's swim there.
What was the inspiration behind this?
We gave Snarkitecture a really broad invitation to do this for us. We wanted it to be memorable. We wanted it to be beautiful. We wanted it to be fun for kids and fun for adults. And something interesting, we've got a historic 19th century building here with these giant Corinthian columns, and creating something that really is a juxtaposition to that. So they went back. We didn't know what they would come back with. What place is interactive and immersive and summertime? And they came up with beach, which had us a little worried because we didn't want sand and water here in our beautiful building. But they said no sand, no water, astroturf and plastic balls. And here we are.
Has anybody ever tried something like this before, bringing the ocean inside?
As far as we know, this has never been done before, certainly not in Washington, D.C. We are far from the ocean, about 3.5 hours, and so it's nice to have something close by. So it's pretty unique here in D.C., and people obviously want it. They are coming in droves already, even just a week in, so we're pretty lucky.
About how many visitors do you get a day?
We're getting a couple thousand a day at least. I suspect here on the weekends, we're probably somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000. That's a lot for us. We are sort of an off-the-mall museum, so we are thrilled.
So tell me why an installation like this is integral to the culture of a city.
I think it's a great way to draw people in a museum. There are a lot of people here who have not been to museums before, which is wonderful. For us, we are a museum about the built environment. Our goal is for every exhibition and program we do that people leave here thinking differently about their built world, that they realize that people designed this, that there was a hand into every one of these buildings and every choice that was made. And I think having this in here and seeing this juxtaposition of this modern white sleek box with this 19th century building with these crazy columns 7 stories high here in our atrium is making people look up and think about that. And we certainly hope that they walk out of here thinking about things a little bit differently and looking a little bit closer at their environments.
What has the feedback been so far? Do you think you're getting the reaction that you wanted?
We really are. People are looking closely and having a great time. I know the designers, one of their hopes was that people would really behave like they are on the beach. And I didn't think it would happen, but it is actually happening. People are sitting at the water's edge and dangling their feet. They are sitting in the beach chairs reading a book. They are getting a snack at the snack bar. They're doing cannonballs off the end of the dock. So they are really doing what we hope they would do and enjoying the space. And they are having a ball.
Have you done a cannonball off the end of the dock yet?
I've done a cannonball and a truss fall off the end of the dock, and it is more fun than I ever could have imagined.
Thanks, Amy Blazik, for that report from Washington, D.C. You can experience the beach for yourself until early September. And that brings us to the end of today's show. Thanks again to my studio guest, Ossian Ward. You have been listening to Culture on Monocle 24. My producer was a one-woman summer holiday herself, Holly Fisher. Join us again at the same time next week. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bounds, and thank you very much for tuning in.